This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, a policy backflip. Millions more Australians to get ultra-fast internet in an NBN shake-up. But whatever the politics behind it, is it going to help? And with the virus still wreaking havoc across the globe, Australia signs up to an initiative to ensure that no one gets left behind if a vaccine is developed.
When we know vaccine nationalism, with the US not funding this, I'm just saying America first, really stuff the rest of the world. I'm proud that the Australian government has put its money up.
Well, after months of family separation and stalled economic activity due to COVID-19 restrictions, there'll soon be relief for many Australians, especially those living in border communities. South Australia will open its borders to New South Wales from midnight tonight, while Queensland is looking to relax its restrictions for more than 100,000 people south of its border. But the sense of optimism is tempered by warnings from some health experts who say the borders may not remain open permanently. Gavin Coote reports.
It's the right time. South Australia's Premier Stephen Marshall says he's ready to open up his border to New South Wales.
This is absolutely massive. New South Wales is the second largest market for visitors into South Australia.
The move comes after New South Wales recorded no new cases of community transmission for the second day in a row. And on the state's far western fringe, many residents in the mining town of Broken Hill are planning their trip interstate as early as tomorrow. Peter Nash is one local who's been eager to reunite with his two children and young grandchildren who live in Adelaide.
As much as we're in the far west of New South Wales, our relationships, whether they be family, medical, health, education, retail, has always been through South Australian and predominantly Adelaide. So to have the border closed for what has been 6 months has been really tough for the local community to deal with.
The Broken Hill businessman reckons the Barrier Highway, which links the two states, is about to get a whole lot busier in both directions.
Look, I think it's going to be two ways. It's not only that Broken Hill people haven't been able to go to Adelaide, it's there's lots of South Australian former Broken Hill people that have wanted to come back home to see their family. So it'll be a two-way street. There'll be lots of Adelaide, South Australian people travelling back to Broken Hill to meet up with family.
It's not just on the western edge of New South Wales where border communities are now celebrating.
Obviously, the news that border restrictions are going to be eased as of the 1st of October, very much welcomed by our industry as a whole, and obviously timely leading into Christmas as well.
That's Peter Liotta, a builder at Tweed Heads on the New South Wales-Queensland border, where restrictions are also about to be slightly relaxed. The Queensland government will shift its border bubble further south next Thursday, allowing a further 150,000 New South Wales residents to apply for a permit to enter.
The Gold Coast and Northern Rivers building industries have always been intrinsically linked to one another. And I'm positive that there'll be a concerted effort there for people to gear up again as fast as possible leading into Christmas. And really what it means is that people will have money in the bank from our industry come Christmas time. It means they'll be starting off 2021 more positively than what we thought we were going to before.
That optimism is being reflected in the travel industry too. Virgin, Qantas and Jetstar have now added more flights to their schedule. Daily services between Sydney and Adelaide resume tomorrow, while Canberra will receive more flights from the Gold Coast and Brisbane. But Adrian Esterman, who's a professor of biostatistics and epidemiology at the University of South Australia, argues it's all a bit premature.
If it was up to me, I wouldn't open the border. I would only open the border when New South Wales could demonstrate that they had eliminated COVID-19. And by that, I mean 28 days without any community transmission. And they're not anywhere near there yet.
Adrian Esterman argues most states have shown they've eliminated COVID-19, with the exception of the three major eastern states.
I'm in favour of being more cautious and saying New South Wales is getting there, but I'm not going to open my borders until they are really clear of COVID-19. All it takes is one case to come across and the whole thing will start up like it did in Victoria.
Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews has also flagged a potential easing of restrictions from next week, after today announcing Melbourne's dropped below the target number of cases the state had planned for.
That's Gavin Coote reporting. Well, globally, the coronavirus pandemic is showing little sign of slowing. Case numbers are surging across Europe and the UK, And in the United States, the death toll has reached 200,000. Hopes are pinned on the development of a vaccine that can beat the virus. Australia is now joining a worldwide effort to ensure that no one gets left behind. Nick Grimm reports.
In France, cases have been growing by up to 10,000 every day. And in the spirit of a wartime rally to arms, French President Emmanuel Macron has told the UN General Assembly that the world must face down a brutal, dizzying new reality.
The only solution can come from our cooperation through the international organisations that we so very much need.
There are unquestionably difficult months to come.
With the UK now on a similar trajectory to its European neighbours, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is also calling for unity.
But now is the time for us all to summon the discipline and the resolve and the spirit of togetherness that will carry us through.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, too, urging international action to ensure a successful vaccine or vaccines are shared around the world.
COVID-19 knows no border. It knows no nationality. It knows no race.
Nobody young, below the age of 18, like nobody.
It all stands in stark contrast with the US president's latest comments downplaying the threat of a disease that's now claimed 200,000 American lives.
But it affects virtually nobody. It's an amazing thing.
To put this into perspective, this is equivalent to a 9/11 happening every day for the last 67 days.
Dr. Alexandra Phelan is an expert in global health law at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Global Health Science and Security. She accuses Donald Trump of not only failing his own citizens, but the rest of the world too.
Really, it comes down to a matter of political leadership, not listening to scientific and evidence-based guidance from experts that otherwise would have put the US at the forefront of the response.
The United States is also going it alone on vaccine development, refusing to be part of the World Health Organization's COVAX initiative, which will see successful candidates rolled out around the world to both rich nations and the poor. Australia is one of 156 nations to join that effort, a move welcomed by the Reverend Tim Costello, who has been leading the End COVID for All campaign.
When we know vaccine nationalism, with the US not funding this, just saying America first, really stuff the rest of the world. I'm proud that the Australian government has put its money up.
What's wrong with that approach taken by the US, for example? Why shouldn't countries just be concerned about their own citizens?
Because this is a virus that has biologically connected the whole world. And it shows that even though our borders might be shut, our hearts can't be shut, not just out of compassion, but also out of self-interest. In Australia's case, you know, New Guinea's about 10 kilometres across a little bit of water, and therefore if the virus is raging there, we are at threat.
And please excuse the gambling metaphor, but it's all about hedging our bets too, isn't it? I mean, the danger with picking particular vaccines is they may yet prove to be ineffective. This is spreading the risk.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Australia's made a bet on the Oxford vaccine, but it may not come off. This actually is hedging our bets because it's literally 160 vaccines in trial and saying this money is for whichever one of them works. Look, the only concern I really have is I still think the COVAX facility is undersubscribed. I think it needs, probably for this to work, nearer to $6 billion. And with America not in and other nations still not in, we still need to see some money up front. But it is absolutely hedging our risk.
That's the Reverend Tim Costello. Well, tens of thousands of Australians are still waiting anxiously to get back into the country. They say the National Cabinet decision last Friday to increase the number of Australians who can return has made little difference. It's a frustrating wait for some, as Jane Barden reports.
COVID killed Graham Archer's UK World War I battlefield tourism business, so he and his wife decided to leave the UK and come home to Australia. Then he had to have open heart surgery in London. And waiting for the follow-up operation, he's become increasingly alarmed as the UK's COVID cases surge.
We're scared stiff. You know, winter's coming now, the nights are drawing in, summer's over, and of course, unfortunately, the UK just let it go way too far with all of the relaxation of the rules, etc.
There are strict limits on the number of Australians allowed to travel home, and Graham Archer's worried whether he'll get bumped off the flights he's been able to book back, and they're for March.
Having to wait now until through winter, past Christmas, to get back home is scaring us all. We're in touch with other groups and we're all really, really concerned, not just about our personal circumstances, but about our health, because this is back on again and we can't get out of here.
The Prime Minister is stressing that his National Cabinet agreement with the states last week to offer more quarantine places so he could lift the cap on international arrivals from 4,000 to 6,000 per week will help more stranded Australians. But from Graham Archer's perspective, having also worked for years in the airline industry, that rise won't solve much.
The increase in caps last week actually works out, talking to a carrier, around about 5 seats a flight. So it really hasn't helped. We're all dumbfounded because one concentrated exercise could bring all the Australians back in 4 or 5 charter flights.
Australian finance consultant Liam Steele is stuck in London with his wife and 2 young children. He's now spent $30,000 on plane tickets, but worries that still may not get his family home.
They say they're trying. He's the Prime Minister. If he can't do it, who can?
Olympic hockey ruse gold medalist Lee Capes and her partner, the performance director for Indian hockey, have just got out of Delhi, where COVID cases are also surging.
India's getting 98,000 new cases every day. We were in danger. We would walk out, try to get out just to get food. And people are out there in the masses not wearing masks.
After maxing out her credit cards, spending $20,000 getting bumped off flights by 3 different airlines, she finally managed to get a seat on an Indian government plane that was being sent to Australia to bring stranded Indians home.
Countries such as India are bringing their people back. They're filling up the flights and they're getting people back. And Australia's not. Australia's put the planes out to pasture.
She was saddened by the aircraft's many empty seats.
Our flight just broke my heart to see we had 10 rows each. You know, we were in the front section of economy and there were 7 of us.
Now in hotel quarantine in Perth, she's among those calling on all Australian governments to do more.
Between now and Christmas, it can be all hands on deck and get our Australians back into Australia.
That's Australian Lee Capes talking to Jane Barden from quarantine in Perth. And the Foreign Affairs Department has responded by saying the government has so far helped 27,000 citizens to return on more than 353 flights. It says it sympathises with Australians overseas who are affected by the state's international caps and is continuing to explore options to help Australians access flights on a commercial basis. On ABC Radio, across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, for years, the National Broadband Network has been at the centre of political warfare over whether the $51 billion project has been a cut-price lemon. But now the NBN is getting a multi-billion dollar upgrade to improve speeds with fibre instead of the controversial mixed technology. Rather than being billed as a policy rethink, the federal government says the upgrade was always part of the plan and that the pandemic has provided the trigger. With more, I spoke earlier with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. So, Peter, what is this? Is it a policy backflip or moving with the times?
Well, good afternoon, Sally. There is a sense of back to the future, right back to the initial plan announced by Labor under Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. And that was to deliver fibre to the home for 93% of premises and businesses and fixed wireless for the rest. Now, that, of course, was switched to a cut-price multi-technology mix that instead provided fibre to the node. That was back in 2013 when the Coalition threw Mr Rudd's NBN blueprint right out the window. But like most things, the pandemic has changed the parameters of this world, and the NBN Co will now spend $4.5 billion upgrading the NBN network to increase speeds for up to 75% of fixed lines, so more fibre being delivered. As you said, is this a back down or a rewriting of history? Well, speaking in Canberra this morning, the Communications Minister Paul Fletcher made it pretty clear that he thought that this was the plan all along and that the pandemic was the timely reason to do it.
When COVID struck, millions of Australians moved overnight to working and studying from home. And the NBN has been absolutely critical in allowing that to happen.
That's the Communications Minister, Paul Fletcher. Peter, so given the controversy around the NBN and the Coalition's decision to take the cut price option, how's this been received by the telco industry?
Most in the industry seem pretty relieved about the upgrade at last and the acceptance that fibre is not just about the future but needed right now. I spoke to Luke Clifton, the group executive at Macquarie Telecom, not your big telco like Telstra or Optus, but a telco relying on the NBN to build up things like cloud services for businesses of all sizes. Mr. Clifton told me the politics need to be put aside and the decision to upgrade the NBN makes a lot of sense.
Initially, 10 years ago when some of these decisions were being made to roll out technology on a certain type of infrastructure, well, it was really about getting fast broadband out to more consumers and businesses quickly. But now as technologies improve in speed and price, it makes sense to upgrade the network.
So was the initial Labor plan right, and could we have had a much faster fibre concentrated NBN now?
The decision was made in the past that that was too much money. Now the cost of providing fibre and those type of speeds are cheaper. Move their document transfer, their applications, the way that they communicate with both staff and their customers online.
So is this upgrade going to ultimately mean lower prices for consumers and businesses?
Absolutely.
That's Luke Clifton, Group Executive at Macquarie Telecom, and earlier the ABC's Peter Ryan. Well, the divide between the US and China is a little wider today after both nations traded accusations in taped addresses to the United Nations General Assembly. President Donald Trump has called on the UN to hold China accountable for failing to contain the coronavirus pandemic, while China says the US must be condemned over its response to the virus, which has now killed more than 200,000 Americans. At the same time, the UN Secretary General has pushed for a global ceasefire until the end of the year so that all countries can fight the pandemic together. Barney Porter reports.
The 75th anniversary of the UN General Assembly was supposed to be held with great fanfare. But amid the pandemic, world leaders have been forced to convene electronically for an unprecedented high-level meeting. And President Donald Trump has used his pre-recorded speech to say the UN must hold China accountable for, as he described it, unleashing this plague onto the world.
In the earliest days of the virus, China locked down travel domestically while allowing flights to leave China and infect the world. China condemned my travel ban on their country, even as they canceled domestic flights and locked citizens in their homes. The Chinese government and the World Health Organization, which is virtually controlled by China, falsely declared that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission. Later, they falsely said people without symptoms would not spread the disease.
The Chinese have immediately hit back. Zhang Jun is China's ambassador to the United Nations.
This is the country with the most advanced medical system, with the most advanced medical technology, but still they have ranked number one in confirmed cases and in lost lives.
He's also returned serve on who should be judged for failings.
It should be the United States held accountable for losing so many lives and with their irresponsible behaviours.
Cue the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres with a subtle swipe at both camps.
We must do everything to avoid a new Cold War. We are moving in a very dangerous direction. Our world cannot afford a future where the two largest economies split the globe in a great fracture each with its own trade and financial rules and internet and artificial intelligence capacities. A technological and economic divide risks inevitably turning into a geostrategic and military divide, and we must avoid these at all costs.
And perhaps a not-so-veiled swipe at particular personalities.
And we must be guided by science and tethered to reality. Populism and nationalism have failed. Those approaches to contain the virus have often made things manifestly worse.
The trading of accusations between the US and China has come on the same day as Johns Hopkins Uni confirmed the US death toll from the virus had passed 200,000, with the number of cases nearing 7 million. Later, when asked to comment on the figures, President Trump found a way to have yet another swing at China.
Well, I think it's a shame. I think if we didn't do it properly and do it right, you'd have 2.5 million deaths. If you take a look at alternatives, you could have 2.5 million deaths or something thereabouts. You could have a number that would be substantially more. With all of that being said, we shouldn't have had anybody. And you saw my United Nations speech. China should have stopped it at their border. They should have never let this spread all over the world. And it's a terrible thing.
The top U.S. infectious diseases expert, Anthony Fauci, has described the U.S. toll as very sobering and in some respects stunning. On CNN, a very diplomatic Dr. Fauci was asked to reflect on the figure.
President Trump says he would give the federal government an A or a B in his handling of the pandemic response. What grade would you give the response?
Take a look at the numbers and make up your own mind. I mean, we don't need a soundbite from me. Take a look at the numbers.
And those numbers are likely to rise very quickly. He's also warned that with the advent of winter, the US is now entering a high-risk period for rising infections in the lead-up to the presidential election.
Barney Porter reporting. Well, when Beirut's port was devastated by a blast last month, the city's restaurant and nightclub strip in the suburb next door was hit hard. In a city known for religious conflict and extremism, the suburb of Mar Mikhael was a welcoming area for hipsters, artists and the LGBTQI community, who have now lost their only safe place. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Andrea Najarian's family apartment was destroyed by the Beirut blast and he was badly hurt.
This is my blood here.
The building is directly opposite Beirut's shattered port in the city's Mar Mikhael neighbourhood.
I was here when the explosion happened on August 4th. It was very traumatic at the time. I couldn't really speak for the first 2 weeks.
Mr. Najarian's body is covered in new scars. The 23-year-old needed several surgeries and still wears a brace on his arm. His workplace, a nearby nightclub, has also been destroyed.
I used to perform here in drag, so it's the first time I see it this way. It's kind of overwhelming.
Mar Mikhael was Beirut's bohemian nightclub district, the only place where people openly flouted Lebanon's ban on same-sex relationships. Sandra Mellum's queer-friendly nightclub was shut by coronavirus, then damaged by the blast.
Me and most of my friends live in these areas. The safe spaces that we have in the country are few.
Homosexuality is still a criminal offence in Lebanon. A recent court decision allowed same-sex relationships to go ahead, but not in public, which is what made Mar Mikhael's tolerance so important. Sandra Melham's trying to raise funds to help the LGBTQ people affected by the explosion.
Covering costs of surgeries post-explosion, we're going to refurbish houses that were damaged, and the ones that completely lost their homes, we're relocating them to new locations.
Firaz Nabulsi went from dancing in drag at Mar Mikhael's clubs to living back with his parents in the Sunni Muslim city of Tripoli after his home was destroyed by the blast.
I stayed for around 2 days and then they told me that I have to leave because their religion and their lifestyle wouldn't accept me being gay and living with them.
It was another blow after the trauma of the explosion.
That I was so close to lose my life. The only thing that my parents had to think about was me being gay and them not accepting me because I'm gay. I was emotionally destroyed when it happened.
Few people feel safe in Beirut anymore, but for this group, the risks are even greater. The blast that took so many lives also took their only refuge.
That's Middle East correspondent Eric Chorchek. Well, that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care and have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Chris Dengate.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Australian universities are shrinking. Their budgets, their student intake, their staff, everything but the buildings. So how bad is it?
Today on The Signal, the damage so far to Australia's university sector and what that might do to the country as a whole in the long run. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.